For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, Beth Murray reveals the strands she wove together to create her breathtaking debut novel, Saving Missy.
And it was through owning a dog that we knew pretty much everyone we walked past in the park. And they're all such different people, but they're brought together by that one thing.
We learn about a petition to make story time part of the national school curriculum.
A huge wealth of wonderful things happen when you have a reading habit, which is why it would be great if all children had access to this, had the same opportunities.
Blogger Holly Tuke shares her thoughts about Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig. And there's important and exciting news about how you download your books from the RNIB library. That's all coming up in today's Read On. When Beth Murray submitted the manuscript of her debut novel, Saving Missy, she could scarcely have imagined that it would start a bidding war between 10 publishers. But that's what's happened. It's a story about community, loneliness, and unexpected friendships that has hope at its heart and an underlying air of mystery. Beth came to the studio to tell me more about the story. Beth Murray, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you just set the scene for us?
Well, Saving Missy is about a very lonely, prickly and defensive old woman who has kind of lost touch with her family and friends and sort of faded out of society. And the story is about how she reconnects and builds a new life for herself. But she also has some secrets that are holding her back, and it's about whether she can get past them.
And part of the way that she finds her way back into the community is through taking care of somebody's dog. And I understand that actually the whole idea for the book came to you whilst you were walking your own dog and pushing a pushchair on maternity leave.
Yes, that's right. I just spent a lot of time pushing the pushchair because that was how my son got to sleep. And obviously the dog would come too. And it really struck me that when we moved to that area, we didn't really know anyone. And it was through owning a dog that we knew pretty much everyone we walked past in the park. And they're all such different people, but they're brought together by that one thing. And it just struck me that that was a really interesting way to do one simple thing that would transform someone's life. It didn't have to be a dog. It could have been a hobby of some kind. But that was the one that I chose.
Yeah, there's a rather lovely sentence where you say the awkwardness of the first line of conversation is broken by having a dog because you've got something in common.
Yeah, and I find that because I can sometimes feel a bit diffident in social situations. But that is never the case when I see a dog. I'm completely unembarrassable about running up to people's dogs and rolling in the grass with them. So it just seemed like it's a natural way of breaking down barriers immediately.
And as you say, your main character, Missy Carmichael, she's 79 years old and she's lost touch with all her family, really, and she's rattling around this big old house in London.
That's right. And I'd been on my travels around Highbury and Stoke Newington, where I live. I had noticed that there are an awful lot of very, very huge houses, and they're all broken up into flats. But there is the odd house that still stands intact. And I started to think, how on earth would anyone be rich enough to afford one of those houses? Because there must be hundreds of rooms in them. They're massive. And then I thought, well, if you were old and you bought a long time ago, you know, the 50s or 60s, when it wasn't such a gentrified area, when house prices weren't so extortionate, then you'd end up in this gigantic house. And that seemed really interesting.
And you're clearly very interested in exploring the generational differences between people. As you say, Missy could afford that house back in the late 50s, early 60s, but her millennial neighbour, Angie, can only afford a very small flat, which she shares with her young son. Clearly something you've observed as you've been wandering around.
Yes, and I mean, it's hard not to be aware of the inequality that exists with housing, and particularly where I live in Islington, you get very, very big, beautiful Georgian houses alongside council blocks. And I'm aware a lot of the time of the people who can afford the Georgian houses and the other people who are struggling. So I wanted to reflect that. Again, because the dog brings sort of diverse people together, you're able to explore what that means for Angela, living in a top floor flat that she can't really afford, that isn't really big enough, but not really anything else she can do about it.
And she's a wonderful, wonderful, spiky Irish single mum, isn't she? You must have had great fun writing her.
Yes, and people ask me, oh, you know, are your characters based on anyone that you know? And obviously, the disclaimer at the front of the book makes me say, no, not at all. And of course, in some form, they are. You know, you might start with one characteristic of someone you know, and then it evolves from there. But funnily enough, with Angela, she just sprang fully formed onto the page. And I don't know where she came from. I didn't particularly plan her, but she just sort of barged in.
And she provides a lot of the comedic value in the book. And I believe, actually, you left university wanting to write comedy.
Yes. Well, when I was at university, I was in Footlights. And all of us lot in Footlights thought we were going to be the next Monty Python and, you know, hit the world of television hard. But it's a really difficult thing to get into. And some of my friends did and had huge success writing comedy, but I never quite managed it. I went into a different field of television instead. But I guess I always kind of hankered after that alternative life that I imagined for myself. I quite like writing comedy. It's nice. It's fun.
Well, you certainly found your comic voice with Angela, I think. So it's, now, you went into TV. I think I can tell from the way you've written Saving Missy. You've worked on shows like The Secret Life of Four-Year-Olds and 100-Year-Old Drivers. You are obviously rather fascinated by generational differences, by the way different ages of people see things.
Yes. I mean, obviously, The Secret Life of Four-Year-Olds is such a wonderful show, and I helped with the development on it. And I was just fascinated by the casting tapes of these four-year-olds that would come in, because they were just so unselfconscious and unworldly and pure. And we were reflecting on that when we were developing the show, the fact that that doesn't really exist, to find a cast that are so unaware of the cameras and not performing in the way that most humans do. So I loved that purity and unselfconsciousness that children have. And then conversely, we were developing 100-Year-Old Drivers, which I think you could probably guess what it is from the title. And in the casting process with that, we discovered that, firstly, anybody who's approaching 100 who can still drive is a fascinating character. But also, the thing that they shared was that they redefined your idea of what was old, that you didn't think of them as doddery or old-fashioned or backwards in any way. They were alert and curious, and many of them were frighteningly fit. And I wanted to reflect some of that in Missy, who is, you know, for all that she's approaching 80, is vigorous and has a kind of curiosity about life.
She's got a rather marvellously analytical mind as well. We find out that she did very well at university, but like a lot of women, sacrificed a career for a family. And yet that interest in life, that interest in understanding people has never really left her.
No, and I think from what I saw of the cast of 100-Year-Old Drivers is that's what keeps them going. The openness and the willingness to try new things. And at the beginning of the book, Missy is quite kind of waspish and judgmental. But deep down, she is incredibly open-minded and curious, and I wanted to bring that out of her as the book went on. Because, yes, in a way, her talents were wasted, but it depends on how you look at it, and it's something that she feels frustrated by, but this is an opportunity for her to have a second chance at life and use that brain of hers again.
And one of the opportunities that she takes up is to be a volunteer reader at her local library. And we also find out that at one point in her life, she'd been approached to record a talking book. So she finds her voice through books.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I always imagined that Missy had an incredibly beautifully modulated voice with perfect diction. And I quite liked the idea that that could have been, it was another opportunity that she turned down. And I think if I remember rightly, when I was thinking about the timeline of it, it was sort of towards the beginning of the talking books history. And that she was very flattered by the option. But in the end, I think she moved to London and it was never a possibility. But I think Missy would have made a brilliant narrator of books.
Well, yes, I could imagine her coming here. We've got narrators who read our talking books who are the same vintage as Missy. And, well, rather like Harriet Walter, can do all the fantastic voices. How lucky were you? getting Harriet Walter to narrate Saving Missy?
It was an absolute dream, because I'm such a fan of hers, because two of my favourite series of all time are The Crown and Succession, which she's been in both of those. So when my publishers told me that they'd managed to secure her, I was just completely dazzled. And I was lucky enough to go to the recording for a little while. And it was just such a joy to sit there listening to her, because she did things with my words that were just so thrilling.
Well, I have been absolutely hooked over the weekend. I'm only three quarters of the way through, so I don't want any spoilers, Beth. But she brings all the characters to life so perfectly. It's like listening to a cast recording, actually.
I know, she is utterly brilliant. And the voice that she has for Missy just sounds just right to me. And she has this kind of timbre to her voice. She makes herself sound older, and then sometimes younger, as the occasion demands, which I just thought was so clever. I have no idea how she did it, but it remains one of the great honours of my life to sit in a recording booth and listen to her talk.
And are you a big fan of audiobooks, or do you still pick up a paperback?
Well, I have a great memory of when I was younger. We used to sit in the car listening to Garrison Keillor read his own work, Tales of Lake Wobegon. And he's got a beautifully melodious voice, a very, very gentle voice. And for some reason, that makes me feel tremendously comforted to remember listening to him reading his own books in the car as the rain beat down on the roof. So I do have a bit of a history. And now we play audiobooks to our sons at night, and sometimes I'll sit in a darkened room with them and listen along.
For our American listeners, I know Saving Missy has got a different title in the States. Could you share that and the reasons for why it is different?
Yes, it's called The Love Story of Missy Carmichael in the States, which was the original title. And I do love it still, because it gives you the sense that this is a love story, but not in the traditional sense. It's about love in all its forms, whether that's platonic or friendship or often marriage too, or parental love, or even love for a pet.
The book starts with a rather beautiful Plato quote about that.
Every heart sings a song incomplete until another heart whispers back. And it's actually attributed to Plato, but I think there's some debate about whether it really is. But I still love the quote, whoever wrote it.
Exactly, whoever wrote it, it's a beautiful quote. Beth Murray, thank you for writing a beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
It was bitterly cold the day of the fish stunning, so bitter that I nearly didn't go to watch. Lying in bed that morning, gazing at the wall since the early hours, I'd never felt more ancient, nor more apathetic. So why in the end did I roll over and ease those shrivelled feet of mine into my new sheepskin slippers? A vague curiosity, maybe. One had to clutch on to that last vestige of an inquiring mind, stop it slipping away. Still in my dressing gown, I shuffled about the kitchen making tea and looking at my emails to see if there were any from Alistair. Well, my son was busy, no doubt, with his field work. Those slippers he bought me for Christmas were cosy in the morning chill. There was a message from my daughter, Melanie, but it was only to tell me about a documentary she thought I might like. She often mistook her father's tastes for mine. I ate dry toast and brooded over my last conversation with her, and for a second bristles of shame itched at the back of my neck. It felt easier to ignore it, so instead I read the newspapers online and saw that David Bowie had died. At my age, reading obituaries is a generational hazard, contemporaries dropping off one by one. Each announcement an empty chamber in my own little revolver. For a while, I tried to turn a blind eye, as if ignoring death could somehow fob it off. But people kept dying, and other people kept writing about it, and some perverse imp obliged me to keep up to date. Bowie's death upset me more than most, although I never really listened to his music. I did remember him introducing the little animation of the snowman, but when we watched it with my grandson at Christmas, they'd replaced the introduction with something else. So my one recollection of Bowie was him holding a scarf and looking sombre and for some reason the image was a disturbing one. The unmade bed beckoned, but then Leo's voice in my head, as it so often was, "Buck up, Mrs. Carmichael, onwards and upwards." So I went up to my room, put on my thickest pair of tights and a woolen skirt, grimacing at the putrid blue veins, and creaking along with the stairs on the way back down to fetch my coat.
Harriet Walter narrating Saving Missy by my guest Beth Murray. Available from the RNIB Library as TB705058. And Beth will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, important and exciting news for those of us who download our books from the RNIB Library. And blogger Holly Tuke finds reasons to live with Matt Haig. But first, as we've just heard, the protagonist of Saving Missy finds company and fulfilment by volunteering to read to children at her local library. But as we all know, many libraries have closed over the past decade, and many children don't have access to the vital stimulation that books provide. In light of this, children's publisher Egmont has created a petition to make story time part of the statutory curriculum. Alison David from Egmont told Robert Kirkwood more about the campaign.
Children's independent reading is in crisis. Less than a third of under-13s read independently every day, and it's declining every year. In light of this, Egmont Publishing have created a petition to make daily story time a part of the statutory curriculum. Joining me to chat about this will be author Jenny McLaughlin, the author of The Land of Roar and Flirty Dancing, amongst many more, and Alison David, the Consumer Insight Director at Egmont. Alison's studies include the Reading Magic Project and Stories and Choices. She's also the author of Help Your Child Love Reading, which is available from the RNIB Library. But first of all, let's hear from Jenny McLaughlin, author of Flirty Dancing, which is read by Nicola Barber.
A small naked person is licking me. I don't panic. This happens a lot. The naked person starts kissing my face. I smell Marmite and banana and... hang on. The person is not entirely naked. It's wearing wellies. Wellies? This is new. And totally unacceptable. I grope for my phone. 5:34 a.m. 5:34 a.m? B! Emma cries. Happy birthday! Go away. It is not my birthday. I try to push her out of my bed, but she resists and we start to scuffle. Mistake. For a 3-year-old, my sister's a mean wrestler. I briefly consider being grown up, but before I know it, we're having a proper fight. I got you a present! Comes her muffled voice from somewhere around my feet. Present later? I could probably sleep with her down there. It's not so bad. Quite cozy and... present now! She screams. She's clearly in one of her extra special moods, so I say what I always say when I want to get rid of her. Did you hear that, Emma? What? I heard Dad's voice. He's home! Dad's home! He isn't. He's in Mexico. Daddy! She shoots out of my bed and down the stairs, leaving me to roll over and snuggle my face into something warm and squidgy. A forgotten bit of banana, perhaps? I sniff it. It's not banana.
That's a clip of Nicola Barber reading from Flirty Dancing, available in the RNIB Library, in Braille, audio and in giant print. And author Jenny McLaughlin joins me now. Jenny, first of all, tell us about Flirty Dancing.
Well, that was a book. That was the first book I ever wrote. And like lots of authors' first book, it's very autobiographical. I'm afraid the becoming an amazing dancer bit wasn't autobiographical, but the being a very shy teenager part was. So I imagined, as an adult, I learned how to dance, partner dance, I learned to jive, and it made me very confident. And I just thought, wouldn't that have been a wonderful thing to have happened to me when I was a teenager? And that's when I wrote Flirty Dancing.
Also in the RNIB library is Help Your Child Love Reading by Alison David. Let's hear a clip.
Parents often say to me, I don't understand why my child doesn't read because I used to love it so much. I can say with certainty, if you contrast your own childhood with your child's, you can see why. After-school clubs, homework, 24/7 on-tap entertainment from consoles, phones, laptops and television. All these things compete successfully with reading. Think about when you were a child. You will have some memories of technology, but how much will depend on how old you are. In the 1970s, your family might have played the tennis game Pong through the TV. In the 1980s, you may have played Space Invaders in arcades or had an Amstrad computer. Gradually, through the 1990s and beyond, more families got PCs and computer gaming gained in popularity. But whatever you had access to, I can guarantee there is vastly more of it in your child's world now. You would have had plenty of time where there was not much to do, when you were at a loose end and so would have picked up a book. I think many adults who love to read quite possibly came to it in the first place for want of anything else to do. This isn't as odd as it might sound. Reading is nothing more than a habit, and like all habits, it needs time to establish itself.
Alison, tell us about that book.
Yes, I wrote that book to help parents work out how to find the time and the motivation to read to their children, to help them understand how such an amazingly pleasurable thing it is to do, to spend time reading with your child, and what amazing benefits it has on their life and their life chances. A subject very close to my heart and obviously to my working life as well, because I work as a children's publisher and we spend a lot of time and effort trying to understand how to encourage children to read for pleasure.
Now, the reason you're joining us today is that children's independent reading is in decline. Why is that?
I would say there are three main reasons. They're not being read to frequently enough or long enough at home or at school, actually. That their leisure time is very much filled with screen-based digital entertainment, and that chews up a lot of time, so there's less time available for other things, including reading. And also, it's about the school environment, which seems to make reading more of a sort of subject to learn rather than something to do for fun. So those, I think, are the three main reasons.
And why is independent reading, in whatever format you prefer, so important for children?
Well, I think when I was a teacher, which I was before I became an author, I saw firsthand, day in, day out, the incredible advantages that students who read for pleasure had. And I think actually it's interesting that parents just don't know this. It has an astonishing impact on a child's future. For one thing, it helps their attainment. Children who read for pleasure do better at school in every subject, not just English. But perhaps more importantly, it helps them have empathy. It can ease anxiety and mental health problems. It gives children an imagination. It gives them ideas. It just has a huge wealth of wonderful things happen when you have a reading habit, which is why it would be great if all children had access to this, had the same opportunities.
Now, as a teacher, you'll be able to answer that. Do you have the time to read to kids?
I think that when I was a teacher, I know that when I read to the students, it was one of the best parts of the day. I think what's particularly interesting is that reading aloud to children, and a recent study that Egmont have done in a school, has shown that it incredibly increases their reading ability. Just being read to aloud improves their ability to understand books. But the problem is the curriculum is absolutely crammed. There's a big difference between what teachers want to do and what teachers can do. And there are certain things they are having to do which they would probably love to put aside so they could read, not long, just 20 minutes each day, to their class for fun with no agenda, but it gets squeezed out, it gets pushed out. I doubt there are many teachers in the country who don't see the benefits of reading aloud, but I think there are a lot who just don't, simply don't have the time in the school day to do that.
So that's why we've got a campaign going where we want to change the curriculum and help free up time for teachers so that story time is a statutory part of every school day. So, you know, for instance, we wouldn't dream of allowing children to go to school and not have a lunch break, and we think it's so important that you wouldn't dream of allowing a child to go to school and not hear a story. So we've got a campaign going called Statutory Story Time. There's a petition that we can sign on change.org, and we really want to try to raise this at government level and free up teachers' time so that they can do this wonderful thing for every child every single day.
And you have done a study that did reveal the benefits of that.
Yes. So I worked with a school in Stoke-on-Trent where for one term the children were read to daily, as Jenny said, and their reading comprehension absolutely skyrocketed, actually. It improved at double the expected rate just by listening to stories and not being asked any questions, just by the sort of sheer joy of it, the escape, the pleasure. It improved by 10 months over a five-month period, so twice what you'd expect.
So where can people go to sign this petition?
On the website change.org, and also there's information on egmont.co.uk. There's information about our campaign.
And Nicola, if people want to find out more about Flirty Dancing or the Land of Roar, which is narrated by Neil Gardner, where can they go?
Well, I suppose there are all sorts of places. It's available from Orca bookshops. It's available as audiobook online. You can find out about it just by simply Googling The Land of Roar.
Jenny and Alison, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
The American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles, and of course needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became, so we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, important news for those of us who download our books from the RNIB library, and Beth Murray reveals the books of her life. But first, as regular listeners will know, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you're reading, whether they're new titles or old favourites. You can drop us a line by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk, which is exactly what disability blogger and fan of the show Holly Tuke did.
In the old days, before the breakdown, I used to deal with worry by distracting myself, by going out to clubs, by drinking heavily, by spending summers in Ibiza, by wanting the spiciest food, the brashest movies, the edgiest novels, the loudest music, the latest nights. I was scared of the quiet. I was scared, I suppose, of having to slow down and soften the volume. Scared of having nothing but my own mind to listen to.
Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig has been out for a few years now, but I only recently got round to reading it. And how I wish I'd read it sooner. I'd read all the fantastic reviews and heard brilliant things about the book, so I knew I had to read it for myself. I love a true story, and I enjoy reading a good memoir, but this book is really just something else. It is one of the most moving books I've ever read.
But after I became ill, all of this was suddenly out of bounds. I once switched on the radio and heard pounding house music, and it gave me a panic attack. If I ate a Jalfrezi, I would lie in bed that night hallucinating and palpitating. People talk about using alcohol and drugs to self-medicate, and I would have loved to dull my senses. I would have taken crack if I thought it would help me ignore the hurricane in my head. But from the age of 24 to 32, I didn't have so much as a single glass of wine. Not because I was strong, as my teetotal future mother-in-law always thought I was, but because I was petrified of anything that would alter my mind.
Reasons to Stay Alive is a personal account of Matt's own experiences of depression and anxiety. He gives a real and honest insight into what it's like to live with a mental illness. He shows you how it can also affect loved ones and family, and tells us honestly how it affected his own family and girlfriend and those around him. Living with a mental illness can be difficult, and it really can be an uphill battle. However, there are positives. It may not seem like it sometimes, but Matt shows how the mental illness really helped him to live. He discusses the things that helped him get through it and how they helped him become stronger, such as love, literature, running, and everything else in between. It is a unique account of living with a mental illness, but it is something that is worth a read.
I went 5 of those years refusing even to take an ibuprofen. Not because I had been drunk off my head when I first became ill. The day I became ill, I hadn't had so much as a sip of alcohol and was in a comparatively healthy patch. I suppose it was just that feeling that my damaged mind lay precariously in the balance, like the bus hanging off the edge of a cliff in the Italian Job, and that the gold/alcohol might look tempting, but to reach for it would be to send yourself falling towards a fatal end.
It is individual and personal, whereby Matt shares his own experiences, recognising that everyone's experiences are different, but in a way it's something that many people can relate to. The book gives hope to others living with any form of mental illness, but it also helps to raise awareness to those who may not be, or those who just want to learn a little bit more. The overall message is very positive and empowering, and will leave anyone feeling inspired and empowered whether you have a mental illness or not. I really did think the book was more than a memoir. Yes, Matt shares his own experiences, but he also shares what helped him, the things that helped him to learn to love his mental illness in a way, and how he got through it. So it is a memoir, but it's also a help book in a way, because there are things that people can take from it, and the message is positive and people can remember that. The book teaches us to celebrate the small moments and the victories, and no matter what, it reminds us that there are reasons to stay alive.
So this was the problem. Just when I really needed to take my mind off something, I couldn't. My fear was such that even after smelling a glass of Andrea's red wine, I would imagine those inhaled molecules entering my brain and tilting it further away from me. But this was a good thing. It meant I had to focus on my mind, like in an old horror movie. I was pulling back the curtain and seeing the monster. Years later, I would read books on mindfulness and meditation and realise that the key to happiness, or that even more desired thing, calmness, lies not in always thinking happy thoughts. No, that's impossible.
Reasons to Stay Alive is narrated by Matt himself, and this really does give a personal and extra touch. I would recommend this book to anyone who wants to learn more about mental illness, so someone who might be struggling, or for anyone who just wants to delve deeper into a nice memoir. I think this book is one of my favourite books I've ever read, and it is definitely something that I would read again.
No mind on earth with any kind of intelligence could spend a lifetime enjoying only happy thoughts. The key is in accepting your thoughts, all of them, even the bad ones. Accept thoughts, but don't become them. Understand, for instance, that having a sad thought, even having a continual succession of sad thoughts, is not the same as being a sad person. You can walk through a storm and feel the wind, but you know you are not the wind.
Thanks, Holly. Now, before we return to the books of Beth Murray's life, here's some important news about the way we access our books. The new RNIB Reading Services Library has just been launched. It's designed to deliver a raft of improvements, and it's been quite a project. With Overdrive due to go offline at the end of the month, those of us who download our books should now have been contacted with instructions of how to sign up to its replacement, EasyReader. But how straightforward is this, and what are the benefits? I invited Alison Long from RNIB Reading Services onto the show to give us more details. It's all up and running, the new Reading Services Library, and it's been quite a project. For those who haven't yet tuned into this, can you just tell us what it's all about and some of the benefits that we're hoping it's going to bring?
Yeah, so we are closing RNIB Overdrive at 31st of March. We have a new online service. We call it our online reading service. So really it's about what you want to read and how you want to read it. And we know that increasingly customers want to read online or download to a particular device or app. So Overdrive gave us some restrictions. We couldn't develop it any further. And actually, they had stopped supporting some technology like Mac, which meant that some of our customers could no longer access RNIB Overdrive. So time for a change. And we knew the customers weren't particularly wedded to Overdrive. And we've listened to that feedback. And hopefully, we've developed something that is easier to use and will connect with more apps and devices going forward. So it will open up the choice for customers. And it will also bring some new things. So we're concentrating on delivering audiobooks to start with. That's what our Overdrive customers are used to. But for those who've registered on the new service, you will see there are some Braille books, some digital Braille, we call it e-Braille, that we're starting to add. And we will, over the next month or two, add the full collection. And then you will start to see EPUB. So EPUB, digital format that, you know, is used in Kindle and lots of online services. And one of the benefits there is that you can choose to listen to it through synthetic text-to-speech, synthetic voice, if there isn't a real voice recorded edition available. So, you know, again, it's about giving people more choice on what they want to read and how they want to read it.
One of the great benefits of EPUB is that, as with Kindle, you can make the script as large or bold as you want, which basically replaces giant print books as far as an electronic device is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the back end of the platform that nobody gets to see, there is a clever conversion tool. We will store the EPUB file and a customer can decide whether they want that to be downloaded as an e-braille, a synthetic audio, or an EPUB that they can then enlarge, etc., as you've said.
So this has been a two-phase process. Firstly, you've got the system up and running as far as people using desktops or laptop computers are concerned, which is great. And then last weekend, you rolled out the replacement to Overdrive, which I am certainly not mourning the loss of. And we're now all being encouraged to sign up to Dolphin EasyReader.
Yeah, so as you've alluded to, you know, customers found Overdrive quite challenging. Dolphin came along and said they'd like to develop their EasyReader app to support Overdrive. We at that point did say, well, we will be moving, so you just need to know that. We don't want you to invest lots of time and investment. And they continue to do it. And that's been great because it has given customers better access to Overdrive. But, you know, they've also been great in supporting us with the new platform and making it available, enabling us to make the new collection available. And I think there's two important things there. One is, I think people would say the audio quality on Overdrive was quite poor. And some of that will depend on the age of the title. Something that was recorded in the 40s is never going to be a kind of pristine audio quality, even digitised. But obviously the content that we're producing today is far superior. And we had been, because of the format that Overdrive required, we were reducing the quality from the quality that we were producing in the studios. We're delivering Daisy audio, so that studio quality, to the new platform. So I think the two standout comments from customers is how easy the website is to use and how much better the audio quality is.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I've been using EasyReader for the last week now, and the sound is a lot less muddy, and the screen on my mobile phone is a lot less crowded. And for somebody with meaty fingers like me, who prods the wrong part of the screen quite regularly, it's nice not to make quite so many errors whilst I'm trying to download my books.
The other thing is that we couldn't actually put all of the collection on Overdrive. Some publishers didn't allow us to. And we've gone back to those publishers and talked about the new platform and that we are delivering Daisy. And they've all said they're happy for us to make their titles available, which means that customers, regardless of whether you're receiving a CD or USB or downloading, the collection will be the same. And I know that was particularly annoying for Overdrive customers, where if it was a particular publisher's title, they'd have to then phone up and ask if they could have a CD or USB version. We've already got considerably more titles on the new platform than we had on Overdrive.
Well, yes, the first book I downloaded was one of the HarperCollins Agatha Christie collection, which I couldn't get on Overdrive, and I've been thoroughly enjoying Pale Horse with the marvellous Hugh Fraser reading it. And yes, otherwise I would have had to have waited for a memory stick and put it on my Sovereign MP3 reader, which just isn't as portable.
No, so that's great to hear, because that's absolutely where we want to go with the new platform, that a much improved experience and full access to the collection and more. And I know it's not for everybody, and actually some of the publishers like HarperCollins are the exception, because they are producing commercial audio for all of their titles. So that's great, and they share those with us. But publishers will give us EPUB, and it means that some of those titles will never be recorded commercially, and you do have the choice then of being able to access them at the same time as everybody else.
It is wonderful. I mean, from the end user point of view, I just want to have access to all the books that my sighted friends can listen to, and those of us who listen to Jaws every day on our computers actually get quite used to the synthetic voice. So if that's the only way the book is going to be presented, at least we've got hold of it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a bit of a technophobe, and I was worrying that the transition from Overdrive to EasyReader was going to be quite difficult. There were a couple of little things that came up, but I rang the helpline and got through to a chap called Mark Evans in Technology for Life, who, like me, is visually impaired, and he understood exactly the problem and was able to fix it very, very quickly. It's that we no longer require a library card number and password issued by the RNIB, but we set our own one. And that's the major difference, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that has taken some people by surprise. And really, it is. It's almost we've made it too simple. Yeah. But it's a regular, I suppose, sign-up experience. So you use your email address, you set your password. And actually, what we've delivered in this platform is what we call single sign-on, which has absolutely no benefit to customers today. But as we apply this single sign-on to other things like our online shop and our newsagent service and others, it means you will just have literally one set of login credentials for all of your RNIB stuff. So that means that we don't want to know your password. We won't have any involvement in that. That's for you. If you forget it, you can reset it, as you can in any online service. But we've kind of gone for normal, shall we say, in terms of what you would expect the experience to be on any other web service.
So by now, all Overdrive users should have received an email from the Reading Services Library, and that has a link to it so that we can sign up to the new Reading Services Library and directions on how to download Easy Reader. And it's important to mention that even if you have already downloaded Easy Reader in the past, you need to delete that app and download the new one that has the Reading Services Library incorporated into it.
Yes, so all of the letters have gone out, and we've got probably about just over half of our active Overdrive users have already made the switch, so that's great. We do expect there will be some customers that we haven't communicated with because they've changed their email address. So we will be monitoring who's still using Overdrive, and we will make every effort to get in touch with people before that switch off date of the 31st of March.
And for listeners who haven't yet signed up or had the email, how do they get in touch with RNIB so that they don't suffer a loss of service?
So they can get in touch with the helpline in the usual way, or they could email the reading services at rnib.org.uk mailbox, and we're there to help.
Fantastic. Well, I, for one, am a convert. I think the audio quality and the ease of use on Easy Reader is fantastic, and I am just looking forward to a whole new wing of the library being opened up for me.
Yeah, and this is just the start. So I would say to listeners, it's not perfection. These things kind of need to mature. We need feedback, so please give it to us. But there will be some improvements that we will roll out over the coming months. But it's a work in progress, so please get in touch and tell us what you like and what you don't like.
Absolutely. And I just want to reiterate, the Technology for Life guys are absolutely on top of this. I think they've done a bit of destructive testing on the system and they know all its little foibles. So it's important just to get in touch with them as well. Yeah. Ali Long, thank you so much for, I know, an enormous amount of hard work on this. And I'm sure in a few months' time, we'll all be wondering how we lived without it.
Well, a genuine team effort, and we're just pleased that we've got to this point and customers are enjoying it.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show and explaining the new Reading Services Library to the Read On listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks to Alison Long. For more information on the RNIB Reading Services Library, you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email your question to the brilliant Technology for Life team on tfl@rnib.org.uk. Those details again, the number is 0303 123 9999 and the email address tfl@rnib.org.uk. Now it's back to Beth Murray for the books of her life. Beth, was there a book that you read as a young girl that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
The one that springs to mind is actually a book that my dad read to me initially, and it's Watership Down. And there was a particular point, I remember a detail, and it was something like a fly or a bumblebee buzzing in the background. And I zeroed in on that detail. And I remember thinking as a little girl, I love that little thing, how it's brought to life that scene for me. And I would like to write a book where I use detail like that.
In the darkness and warmth of the burrow, Hazel suddenly awoke. Struggling and kicking with his back legs, something was attacking him. There was no smell of ferret or weasel. No instinct told him to run. His head cleared, and he realized that he was alone except for Fiver. It was Fiver who was clambering over him, clawing and grabbing, like a rabbit trying to climb a wire fence in a panic. Fiver! Fiver, wake up, you silly fellow. It's Hazel, you'll hurt me in a moment. Wake up! He held him down. Fiver struggled and woke. Oh, Hazel. I was dreaming. It was dreadful. You were there. We were sitting on water, going down a great deep stream, and then I realized we were on a board, like that board in the field, all white and covered with black lines. There were other rabbits there, bucks and does, but when I looked down, I saw the board was all made of bones and wire, and I screamed. And you said, swim, everybody swim. And then I was looking for you everywhere and trying to drag you out of a hole in the bank. I found you, but you said, the chief rabbit must go alone. And you floated away down a dark tunnel of water. Well, you've hurt my ribs anyway. Tunnel of water, indeed. What rubbish. Can we go back to sleep now? Hazel, the danger, the bad thing, it hasn't gone away. It's here, all round us. Don't tell me to forget about it and go to sleep. We've got to go away before it's too late. Go away? From here, do you mean? From the Warren? Yes, very soon. It doesn't matter where. Just you and I? No, everyone. The whole Warren? Don't be silly. They won't come. They'll say you're out of your wits. Then they'll be here when the bad thing comes. You must listen to me, Hazel. Believe me, something very bad is close upon us and we ought to go away. Well, I suppose we'd better go and see the chief rabbit, and you can tell him about it, or I'll try to. But I don't suppose he'll like the idea at all.
Robin Holmes, narrating Watership Down by Richard Adams. It's also available in Braille and giant print.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, that would probably be a Georgette Heyer, because I'm a huge fan of Georgette Heyer. I think she's wonderful. Read pretty much all her books. And if I had to pick one, I mean, I could pick anyone to curl up with, it would probably be Venetia, because it kind of centres around education, which I like as a theme, but also it's just absurdly romantic.
A fox got in amongst the hens last night and ravished our best lair, remarked Miss Lanyon. A great-grandmother, too. You'd think he would be ashamed. Receiving no answer, she continued in an altered voice. Indeed you would. It is a great deal too bad. What is to be done? His attention caught, her companion raised his eyes from the book which lay open beside him on the table, and directed them upon her in a look of aloof inquiry. What's that? Did you say something to me, Venetia? Yes, love, responded his sister cheerfully, but it wasn't of the least consequence, and in any event I answered for you. He would be astonished, I dare say, if you knew what interesting conversations I enjoy with myself. I was reading. So you were, and have let your coffee grow cold, besides abandoning that slice of bread and butter. Do eat it up. I'm persuaded I ought not to permit you to read at table. Oh, the breakfast table, he said disparagingly. Try if you can stop me. I can't, of course. What is it? She returned, glancing at the volume. Ah, Greek. Some improving tale, I don't doubt. The Medea, he said repressively. Porson's edition, which Mr. Apperset lent to me. I know. She was the delightful creature who cut up her brother and cast the pieces in her papa's way, wasn't she? I dare say perfectly amiable when one came to know her. He hunched an impatient shoulder and replied contemptuously, "You don't understand, and it's a waste of time to try to make you." Her eyes twinkled at him. "But I promise you I do. Yes, and sympathize with her, besides wishing I had her resolution. Though I think I should rather have buried your remains tidily in the garden, my dear."
Maggie Jones narrating Venetia by Georgette Heyer, which is TB 9459.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Oh, I'm reading lots at the moment before I go into my rewrite. So the last book I read was The Foundling by Stacey Halls, and it was absolutely excellent. It's got wonderful, rich historic detail, a cracking story, and it's a rather heartbreaking insight into motherhood.
The room we had entered was papered green, with elegant white plaster piped below the ceiling. There were no flames in the fireplace, but it was warm and brightly lit, with glowing lamps and pictures on the walls framed in gold. A chandelier shivered at the centre. It was the finest room I had ever stood in, and it was crowded with people. I had thought we might be alone, perhaps with a fleet of nursemaids who carried off the babies that would stay. But a score of faces lined the walls, mostly women, who were certainly not nursemaids, fanning themselves and smiling curiously. They were very well dressed and interesting to look at, and they were very interested in us. They might have climbed out of the paintings on the walls. Their necks flashed with jewels, and their hooped skirts were bright as tulips. Their hair was pinned up high and cloudy with powder. There were half a dozen men scattered about too, silver buckled and pot-bellied. Not like Abe, with his drab coat like a bag of horse feed. The men appeared more stern, and many of them were eyeing the mulatto girl, as though she were for sale. They held little glasses in their gloved hands, and I realised for them, this was a party. I was still bleeding. Clara had been born before daylight that morning, and every part of me felt torn. I had not been a mother a day, yet I knew her as well as myself. The smell of her, the little patter of her heart that had beaten inside me, even before she was pulled from me, red and squealing, I'd known what she'd feel like, how heavy she would be in my arms. I hoped they would take her, and I hoped they wouldn't. I thought of Abe's lined face, his eyes on the floor, his calloused hands holding the door for me. He was the only father in the room. Most of the others were alone, but some had brought friends, sisters, mothers, who looked on miserably. Abe would not meet my eye, and had not spoken much on our slow, sad walk from Black and White Court where we lived in the city. But his being there was as good as a hand on my shoulder. When he had reached for his coat at home and said it was time for us to leave, I had almost cried with relief. I had not thought he would come with me.
The Foundling by Stacey Halls, narrated by Hattie Morahan and Laura Aikman, is available commercially wherever you buy your books.
Beth Murray, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. We're also available as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.